Hello and welcome to Databook, a podcast presented by Chief Healthcare Executive. With Databook, we discuss technology, innovation, and the transformation of healthcare. In this episode, we talk with Michael Hamilton, the founder and Chief Information Security Officer of Critical Insight. He talks about the cyber attacks that have plagued hospitals and health systems, emerging threats, and what hospitals can do to better protect themselves and their patients. Well, thanks for joining us today. We're talking with Michael Hamilton, the founder and Chief Information Security Officer at Critical Insight. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Ron, glad to be here.
Let's look at this past year. We've seen a number of high-profile cyber attacks aimed at health systems. HCA Healthcare reported an attack that affected maybe 11 million potential individuals. Has this been the worst year in terms of the number of people that have been affected by cyber attacks at healthcare or health organizations?
Yeah, clearly. And I think it's interesting how some of the tactics have changed to facilitate that number. So while the number of records disclosed is off the charts, the number of organizations that have been hit is actually fairly stable, if not decreasing a little bit. And so a couple of key tactics that we've seen in our analysis of the data breach numbers that Health and Human Services puts up. Number one is that there is an increasing focus on coming in through a third party. So, you know, there's these one-stop shops that are a combination of health records and financial records. And, you know, maybe they're a service provider for a large number of covered entities. And that's the door they're going in. So that as a tactic has really been amplified over this year. And the other one is this, and I think this is super interesting. There's been a shift from a predominantly phishing-based initial access vector to vulnerability exploit, such that when a vulnerability is announced in a piece of technology you have that faces the public network, the internet, it becomes a race. You got to get it patched before they find you because they start looking immediately. So those are two, I think, key things that popped out of our analysis.
Have attacks obviously been HCA is a gigantic health system. Are attackers usually looking at those bigger systems for a bigger payday? Are they increasingly willing to go to a smaller system which might not have the bigger payday, but might have a pretty big return on investment since they may not have the robust defenses? What are attackers targeting?
Well, so some are intentionally, you know, TrickBot, for example, intentionally targets hospitals. But I think what we have seen is target selection is reflective of maximizing payout, but at the same time, minimizing risk. So again, you know, going through a third party, which has poor controls, which may be a service provider to hospitals large and small, you know, that's the way that they're going. And they're really going after the records and you know, unintentionally, but, you know, truthfully, part of this problem we have done to ourselves. When we made it, you know, California Consumer Privacy Act, for example, when we made it so that we could do private right of action and class action suits after privacy information is disclosed, that puts it over and above, you know, the HIPAA fines and things like that, and the additional regulatory oversight. And now it's class action suits 2 days after, you know, one of these disclosures of records. And so we're beating our healthcare sector to death. And some of that's our own fault.
And, you know, there's a lot of attention goes to like the Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Civil Rights. They have the list, sometimes called the Wall of Shame, for those organizations that have breaches affecting over 500 individuals. I mean, you certainly want transparency, but it sounds like there's been some unintended consequences of that.
Yeah, well, the unintended consequence is we made it so that you could sue these organizations. They're on the financial ropes already. You know, they just had a disruption event where they, you know, their revenue's down. You know, the paper we're going to talk about points out what the revenue drop is. And then comes the class action, you know, and all the litigation. So I don't know how our healthcare sector is going to survive this if it keeps up.
Well, you mentioned that paper is a really interesting slash disturbing study at the University of Minnesota looking at what happens to a hospital when a ransomware attack occurs, including looking at some of the risks to patient mortality. Let's talk about that. You're in the field, so maybe these findings weren't surprising to you per se, but were they at least significantly concerning? Are these the type of things that healthcare organizations really need to understand?
Well, apart from, you know, the deep statistical dive, you know, into, you know, the data processing and how this was done, which is interesting, but it's nothing I remember from college 40 years ago. You know, the paper talks about the causal effects of capacity strain, which is a known thing that is studied in the healthcare sector, and then using ransomware as a driver of that strain. There are some interesting results that came out of there that did surprise me, and a lot of this does not. I mean, there have been other studies and a lot of news articles about, you know, here's what happens. You know, you talked about regional effects, you know, when patients have to be diverted, you know, in the area, other hospitals get impacted by that, and all of a sudden their ERs are full. I think the paper said that 4% of hospitals had ransomware events in the period studied, but 25% of hospitals, 1 in 4, had these knock-on effects. So the impact of these events is much broader, I think, than anyone was considering. I'm glad this paper came out. I don't know that this paper has been peer-reviewed and published in a journal. It should be. If it's just an internal paper from the university, you know, that's great. We picked up this paper some weeks ago, and read it. And I did a little deeper dive, you know, before our chat today. You know, again, some of the surprising things. There was one interesting point about the fact that in our healthcare system, we have a tendency to over-treat, so that when there is a disruption, the effects on patients are not as great, since we're dialing back that over-treatment. Now, this doesn't go for every condition there is, but this was an interesting thing that I think I picked out of that paper. Another one for me was that in the study, they broke out different kinds of hospitals, you know, critical access hospitals, sole community, rural. But I didn't see anything that measured and the paper's meaty, so it might be in there. I didn't see anything that measured a geographic distance from equivalent health centers, because that would have something to do with patient mortality as well. If a hospital gets knocked down and the next hospital is 10 miles away, that's one thing. If it's 400 miles away, that's something else. So I would have liked to see, I think, something there.
But still really interesting stuff in that paper in terms of, I mean, they mentioned, I think, ransomware attacks decreasing volume just in the initial week of the attack, 17.5%. Mm-hmm. I mean, at a time when hospitals have challenging margins to be generous, and that's obviously not good news to them. And there's also obviously spillover in the following weeks thereafter too. So this lays out not just the patient risk, but also some of the financial impacts of these attacks as well.
No, in the natural side, I thought it was interesting that the measure used for that was a reduction in Medicare revenue. And that was impacted somewhere around 20% to 40%. So, and that's a huge, you know, revenue stream for hospitals. So I don't know where all this ends. I really don't. You know, if current trends continue and we continue to see the, we'll just call them criminal corporations because that's what they are now. If we see them continue to lean into affiliate and as a service models, we are going to see an explosion in the number of people that are willing to get into cybercrime. And it is unlikely for domestic actors to go after hospitals, but the ones that we have seen, and I know you've read this too, about how MGM and Caesars, the casinos, were basically hit by a group of teenagers and 20-somethings. So here we have this population of young people that grew up with computers in their hands, That are being told it's doesn't make any sense to go into debt for a college degree because you're never going to get a job that pays you enough. And income inequality is such that all the money is fractionated towards just a few people and it's not coming back. And by the way, the planet is starting to really make moves like it's trying to eject us. And here are these really simple ways of getting into crime, and they are embracing this. So, you know, if this continues, not necessarily from our own domestic actors, but globally, you know, hospitals are an easy mark. They're so critical, they're really likely to pay that extortion demand. So, you know, I think we all ought to buckle up here. And I, you know, I hate to say this, but the federal government has got to get much more into this fight. You know, the public harm done by these events, as you know, outlined in this paper very well, versus the private responsibility to make this stuff not happen, is a big disconnect. And we have to address that. And we, you know, my view is we have to address that at our logical border. And we need to start enforcing a standard behavior on our side of that demarc that, if not met, we just start locking countries out, you know, and everybody will say, okay, well, the criminals will just go around that. Okay, well, we're locking your banks out too. So, you know, they can go scream at your elected officials to do something about the criminals if they want to continue to do business with the United States. And if we don't start acting like that, we're going to keep having our rear ends handed to us.
What else should the federal government be doing in terms of helping hospitals and health systems deal with these threats? I mean, is it a matter of, frankly, making more money available to health systems to bolster their networks, their security? Because, I mean, a lot of hospitals that are just on the brink, they're really struggling now. So is it also a funding issue where the feds are just going to have to cough up some more money in this area?
Well, I think it's a funding issue. And, you know, the state local cyber grant program actually does apply to public health institutions. And so there's some funding available there. But yes, more funding needs to be made available to the healthcare sector. And I think more importantly, we need to start making people available to the healthcare sector, because right now they cannot attract and retain qualified practitioners to be in there doing things like keeping eyes on events going on in the network. You know, they most victims find out through a third party that they have been hacked and their records are for sale online, or, you know, a lot of times the FBI will come up and hand them a thumb drive and say, here's all your stuff that's online. You got to do something about that. You got bad guys in here. So if the federal government had some kind of cyber core of public service, where people could go out and be deployed into our, you know, especially rural health, but, you know, health writ large, I think that would go a long way, because this business about eyes on and fast detection is how you make sure that your house is not engulfed in flames if a grease fire happens on your stove. I don't know if that metaphor makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And certainly a lot of places have been getting burned, to say the least. But but that would seem that cyber core seems like an interesting concept, because healthcare organizations have struggled to find and keep talented cybersecurity professionals, because they can make more money elsewhere, even more legitimate organizations like other industries that can pay more. And we'll just set aside the prospect of the bad guys that can also recruit as well. But that seems like, has that gotten some traction at all? Or the idea of even just appealing to people maybe who've served in the military as all, to kind of look into this as an entryway?
Well, this is actually a focus of mine. And this is not what we're here to talk about, but I started this nonprofit called PICES, the Public Infrastructure Security Cyber Education System. We do no cost cyber monitoring for small local governments and now some rural health, so that we make it free, because we use metadata collected from those networks as live fire curriculum for analysts in training in 20 universities across the country. And what we have suggested, and we were talking to DHS about, is once we have students that have gone through this program and they have experience with real-time data in critical infrastructure, if we made a mandatory internship a condition of obtaining your degree, either in local government or in rural health, we would be able to set up this pipeline of people that could spend time in these environments, get more of that operational experience, and then leave that and definitely be super employable at that point. So, you know, this, all these things take time. You got to work with government agencies, you know, but we're pretty focused on this. We want to treat, you know, kind of get away from this 4-year degree in cyber, you know, which is this big fuzzball of things that nobody will ever really understand. Treat it more like trade school. You're going to be an analyst. That's 10th fastest growing job in the country. And as part of your degree, you're going to have to serve a year working in a hospital. And I just, you know, I think this is doable, and, you know, we'll see if we pull this off.
That's definitely an interesting idea. Looking ahead, we're getting nearer to a new year. What you've already talked about some disturbing things. What are some other emerging threats, or what are things to watch in the next year to come where cybersecurity and cyber attacks are concerned?
Whoa. Okay. Well, I think we're going to see very broad scale financial fraud likely perpetrated by China. They've already gotten into more criminal activity away from straight up espionage. And, you know, now they're dipping their toe in infrastructure. You've probably seen the FBI warnings about, hey, China's in our energy infrastructure. But this bit about broad scale financial fraud, all the records that have been stolen, you know, China's got an enormous amount of computing power. If they bring that to bear on the stolen records that never showed up for sale online, which we think they possess, you know, they're going to be able to do things like, you know, across the country, financial fraud, and just put everybody into a tailspin. Additionally, I think the American energy infrastructure is going to be compromised. We saw the Canadian energy infrastructure, not only a refinery, but Suncor, right? They're basically a, you know, energy distribution company. We saw those disrupted recently. The Netherlands has said, yeah, well, Russia did it to us too, hit their energy infrastructure. We know they've done it to Ukraine. Ours is going to happen. Our election is going to be measurably manipulated / disrupted, probably through what's called UOCAVA voting, which is Uniformed Overseas Citizens Accessible Voting Act, I think. This already happened in Ecuador this year. That's the way people that are overseas and deployed military can essentially use a DocuSign-like mechanism to vote. In Ecuador, it was a big denial of service attack that disrupted that. That's going to happen to us. Along with all the disinformation, and again, you know, China bringing to bear all those records they have allows them to surgically target their marks for disinformation. And in our system of the Electoral College, you only need to swing a few tens of thousands of votes in a couple of key states, and in fact, key counties, to swing an election. So this election is going to be nuts. You know, on the upside, I think that what is now obvious state support for criminal actors is going to result in sanctions and possibly more. We're starting, you know, to border on wanting to, you know, conduct military action because of this. You know, the cybercrime last year, they say, it has been reported, was about $8 trillion, making it the third largest economy on earth. All right, this cannot be allowed to continue. And if states are supporting these criminals, we're going to have to get into that fight. You know, there's a few predictions. I think when we're talking about some of the regulatory things that have been happening, because regulation has just been coming out of a faucet, there's going to be a revolt against new regulations. I think from a broad array of the sector specific agencies, right? Health and Human Services, the SEC, EPA, TSA, right? They've all been, you know, using the rulemaking process to further regulate. Going to be big push. That pushback has already started. On the other hand, the states, I believe, will follow New York's lead in creating nearly identical regulations that are immune from all this congressional dysfunction. You know, the regulatory focus is going to shift from preparedness to resilience, right? It's not do these things to prevent the bad thing from happening. It's admit the bad thing is going to happen, get ready to take the punch, and get back up off the mat before the 10 count. So there's a few things I think are coming.
You mentioned New York. That's gotten a lot of attention. I mean, Do you think what they're doing in New York, what Governor Hochul is talked about doing with, I guess, in addition to regulations, also $500 million available, is this a positive step for New York?
It is a positive step. And, you know, the fact that they're going to bust out, you know, $500 million in taxpayer money is probably going to be debated solidly. But it's not just their health department, right? It's their Department of Financial Services done the same thing. You know, they are creating regulations that are just about equivalent to the SEC's and Health and Human Services. And what that does is it, you know, if the regulations coming from the sector specific agencies at the federal level keep getting pushed back, you know, the EPA tried to do it with the water sector, three states sued them, they pulled all that back. Well, if you do it at the state level, Congress can't do anything about that. So I think this is a positive step, and I think we're going to see more of that. On the other hand, I do believe that we're going to get a national privacy statute to avoid 50 states doing what California did and get our arms around this, you know, license to class action every time there's a records disclosure.
Yeah, I really haven't asked much about deep fakes and AI and the role that they're going to play. I mean, is that only going to accelerate in the coming months or in the coming years?
Yeah, well, in good ways and bad ways. I think that AI is probably going to completely replace first-tier analysts and SOC operations. That's already starting to happen. The Gen AI bait that's being crafted is going to lead to even larger losses through business email compromise, you know, fooling people into, you know, redirecting payments and things like that. I think that, you know, adaptive malware that uses artificial intelligence is going to show up shortly. And the fight back will be detection analytics using AI. And so, you know, basically, we're looking at, you know, networks having, you know, for lack of a better term, robots fighting robots. Yeah, I think all that's going to happen.
When I talked to you a couple of months ago, you mentioned that, like, at least health system leaders now have the fear of God in them. They're like more cognizant of the risks and are taking cybersecurity more seriously. What other advice, in addition to having the fear of God in them, should healthcare leaders have looking ahead and at some of these emerging threats?
Oh, yeah. Pay close attention to some of the things going on with claims of negligence. Gartner predicted in 2020, I think, that 3 in 4 CEOs would be held personally liable for cyber events in their organizations that result in public harm. There are right now these negligence suits, ones with PayPal, ones with University of, I can't remember, Minnesota, maybe Michigan, I can't remember. But I would say really pay attention to that. And this guidance that's coming out that is, you know, what sucks all the air out of the room is, oh, mandatory reporting, 4 days, we can't do that. If you read through what not only the SEC, but Health and Human Services and some of the other regulating agencies are saying is, you have to lean into governance, okay? So, you know, board representation, risk governance, so that when we identify a risk, there's actually executive fingerprints on the disposition decision, right? We're going to accept, avoid, mitigate through controls, transfer through insurance, so that it's not just the CISO or the IT team saying, we need to do this, and the corporation doing nothing about it, or saying, well, we'll accept that risk. It's okay to accept a risk, but put your fingerprints on it, because when the time comes, you know, that pucker factor is going to be there. And, you know, that's what's, I think, going to move the needle a lot. So, you know, watch what's going on with all the negligence suits and embrace this governance thing, because it's coming, it's going to land on you, and you're going to have documentation to say, here's what we were doing about these things.
From the upside, you really do need the executive buy-in, the CEOs, the C-suite. They need to be involved in their organization's cybersecurity. It seems like I've heard others say leaving it to the IT is just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, and that's about over, I think, soon. You know, the Republicans in Congress right now are pushing back on the SEC regulation for the mandatory reporting. I think it's interesting. Story came out today that there's a ransomware group that actually filed an SEC complaint against one of their victims for an unreported cyber event. All right. So now, you know, the criminals are taking our own laws and turning those against us. So I think the 4-day reporting is probably, you know, going to go by the wayside, you know, due to this, you know, congressional displeasure with this. But the other things, the governance, you know, that's not going to go away. And so, yeah, you know, pay close attention to what your, you know, if you're in a reg, you know, if you're critical infrastructure, there's a sector specific agency that has the purview over this rulemaking. Pay attention to what they're saying, because it'll likely keep you out of jail at this point.
I know we're getting short on time. Anything else you wanted to mention to hammer home that healthcare leaders should be thinking about? And we've covered a lot of ground. And then obviously you could talk about this for days, but
yeah.
But what anything else that a healthcare leader should be thinking about that we haven't touched on?
Yeah, just limit internet access for your employees as much as you possibly can. Institute a policy of personal use only on a personal device, and just, you know, cut everybody off from the bait, you know, minimize your network traffic, whitelist everything, make sure that you know exactly what goes in and out of that network. You know, you need to reduce your threat surface, and to a large extent, your threat surface is people.
That sounds like a good place to leave it. Mike, thanks so much for taking the time and sharing these insights. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was my pleasure, Ron. Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity to chat.
Thank you for listening to Databook, a podcast by Chief Healthcare Executive, a brand of MJH Life Sciences. You can subscribe to Databook wherever you get your podcasts. For latest news, insights, and analysis of the healthcare industry, visit chiefhealthcareexecutive.com. You can follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. I'm Ron Southwick, Senior Editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. Take care.